This morning, we are pleased to have Glenna Matthews speak to us about the anti-racism of Thomas Starr King. The sermon will be based on the research he has conducted for a recently published book, The Golden State in the Civil War, Thomas Starr King. Specifically, Dr. Matthews will address what California was like in the 1850s, being under the control of Southern Democrats, and a contribution that Thomas Starr King made in changing the political conversation in our state. Glenna Matthews is a historian and a UU living in Laguna Beach, where she was raised. With a doctorate from Stanford, she has written 6 books. She has taught as a tenured associate professor at Oklahoma State and as a visitor at Berkeley, Stanford, UCLA, and UCI. Please welcome Dr. Matthews to the stage.
Oh, no, I'm fine. It's a great pleasure to be here in Fullerton. And before I get to the substance of my sermon this morning, I want to tell you about my personal history with Fullerton. When I was in high school in Laguna Beach, my father briefly owned a small newspaper in Anaheim called the Orange County Sun. That newspaper is now defunct. But at the time that he owned it, one summer, I personed the Fullerton office. And we had a desk in an insurance office. I believe it was on Chapman Avenue. It's been a few years. And I made what had to have been very annoying phone calls trying to drum up business in classified advertising. But more substantively than that, my father, who was a rock-ribbed Republican, committed an act of civil disobedience here in Fullerton at that time. At that time, Fullerton had an ordinance, which was very much in the interests of the then Santa Ana Register and the LA Times, that it was illegal to distribute a newspaper for free. And the Orange County Sun was distributed for free. So my father called the police station and said that at such and such a time he was going to be throwing away, you know, on such and such a corner, he was going to be distributing free copies of the Orange County Sun. And I'd like to say that he went to jail, but he didn't. But I still think it was a pretty gutsy thing to do. He felt that it was antithetical to free speech to have that ordinance, and he went out of his way to defy it. So I'm very proud, actually. I still have the newspaper coverage clippings at home. So that is my personal history with Fullerton, and my father's partner is a glorious one. I think hustling classified ads in an insurance office is probably less glorious, but still, I do have my own history with Fullerton. Well, I want to explain, first of all, why someone whose work before the publication of this book was all in the area of women's history, how I wound up writing a book about California and the Civil War and about Thomas Starr King. And in order to do that, I want to give you a little of my personal history. And I've been thinking about this personal history because, as you know, the Republican convention is going to be starting in a day or two in Tampa, depending on Hurricane Isaac, and then shortly thereafter the Democratic convention. We'll flash back to the summer of 1948. I was a little 9-year-old girl. My dad was a newspaper editor. We were living in Visalia, California at that point. And I was interested in public affairs, and I listened on the radio to the Democratic Convention. And some of you may know that that was a very, very contentious convention. Hubert Humphrey, who sadly, his late years, he came across somewhat as Lyndon Johnson's toady, but Hubert Humphrey had a truly glorious moment where he got up in that convention in 1948 and gave a civil rights speech. And at that point, the Southern Democrats walked out. And I was a little girl, and I listened to that speech. You'll forgive me, because sometimes when I talk about things that mean something to me, it doesn't mean that I'm about to have a crack up on the spot, but I may get tears in my eyes when I talk about this. I knew that something really important was being discussed. And we lived at that point in a bungalow court. And I did not know that my voice could carry all over the bungalow court. And so when I took a shower for the next day or two after hearing that convention, I gave speeches of my own on civil rights. And the neighbors thought that, you know, the little Ingalls girl was mighty eccentric, I'm sure. But ever since I was nine, I've cared intensely about racial justice. I didn't do anything brave during the 60s. I married young. I had children. I was not like our own Unitarian Viola Liuzzo, mother of five, who went south to Selma and was killed. But I did care intensely about racial justice. And when I started graduate school, however, it was also the moment of the birth, really, of women's history. So I became a historian of women, and I think that's an important thing to chronicle, too. But in the mid-90s, I was asked to curate an exhibit on the history of San Francisco. I lived in Berkeley for 20 years. I gave up tenure at Oklahoma State. I found it not a very comfortable place for somebody who was raised in Laguna. And I lived in Berkeley for 20 years. And so I was asked to curate an exhibit on the history of San Francisco. And I knew enough to know that Thomas Starr King had played a very significant role in the history of San Francisco. So I borrowed a letter from the Graduate Theological Union Library, a Thomas Starr King letter, to use in that exhibit. And it was full of passion about, it was written to his best friend on February 24th, 1861, just before the outbreak of the Civil War. And he wrote about giving a Washington's birthday address, and hundreds of people had to be turned away. It was such a moment. And he wrote with such passion. And two things happened. First of all, that letter reached out and grabbed me and told me, you know, this is somebody important. This is an important story. And then the other thing, I don't know, have any of you here encountered the minister I then had in my Oakland church, Rob Eller Isaacs? Well, Rob is a very charismatic fellow. He's now the minister. He and his wife, Jan, are the ministers in St. Paul. I gave Rob a personal tour of my exhibit, and I said, oh, Rob, here's a Thomas Starr King letter, Unitarian, talking about California and the Civil War. And Rob looked at me and he said, Glenna, we need a good book about Thomas Starr King, and you are going to write it. Well, I obviously took him seriously. I was then finishing up other projects, but I knew that I was going to forge a new direction in my career and write about Thomas Starr King. I had, in order to conduct this, to write this book, I had to educate myself about the history of Unitarianism, Transcendentalism. This is not hardship. This is really interesting to read about Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and the Transcendentalists and Civil War history and so on. So it took me about 10 years of work. I And it was almost, well, no, it wasn't almost. It was invariably fascinating. I found, for example, 11 boxes about California and the Civil War in the New York Public Library. They had never been cataloged. Now, since that time, this was 2002. Since that time, the New York Public Library has gotten a grant, and they have a whole collection about California, and not only California, but about the whole country, and the Sanitary Commission, which was the antecedent to the Red Cross. They have a $1 million grant to process it. But at the time I was using this 10 years ago, I found a letter from William Tecumseh Sherman that they didn't even know they had. So it was very exciting. I also found a friend of mine who's an archivist told me that I should go to Ann Arbor, to a rare books library there. And this was one of the more colorful sources I found. 10,000 pages of letters from a medium who came to San Francisco during the Civil War to hold seances. And he worshipped at Thomas Starr King's church. And he wrote letters home to his wife in New England telling her about King's sermons. And he was enchanted. And he thought that Thomas Starr King's sermons were so wonderful because the spirit world was with him. But that's another story. In any event, and the Huntington Library also. So I've 10 years worth of research. So it was Rob Eller Isaacs and my own passion for that letter put me on a journey that was a long one. But I'm happy to say this book came out in May. I had a book party for it at my congregation in Laguna Beach, which was a lot of fun, and Cambridge University Press. So I was very excited about that because if it had been, it's not just a matter of prestige for me, but it's a question that this book will travel around the world because it's the oldest publisher. Actually, Cambridge University Press is the oldest publisher in the world. So it had a humble beginning, this book, but I'm pretty excited about at least this point on the journey. Well, now I want to talk about the substance of what was happening. Roland alluded to the Southern Democrats who were in control. This was a revelation to me. I don't think many of us realize what California was like in the 1850s. The most powerful politician in California was a man named William McKendry Gwynn. I don't know, have any of you heard of William Gwynn? He was a U.S. Senator from California for most of the 1850s. And guess what? He was from Mississippi, and he owned 200 slaves in Mississippi the whole time he represented California. So, what a surprise. California's congressional delegation voted with Southern Democrats throughout the 1850s. I found in material I used at the Huntington Library two members of the state legislature who almost fought a duel because one had called the other one an abolitionist. So to call someone an abolitionist in California in the 1850s those were fighting words. Like, you know, draw, partner. For a Western movie, it almost sounded like. In fact, my research about California in the 1850s, I thought, I wonder why they always set Western movies in Monument Valley or Dodge City, because both San Francisco and Los Angeles were really pretty wild and woolly. Some of you may know that there was vigilantism twice in San Francisco. Los Angeles had fewer than 5,000 people, but it was still the largest place in Southern California. And there were, you know, dozens of murders per year in a town of 5,000. So what California was like in the 1850s was, under the control of Southern Democrats, women were a small fraction of the population. The gold rush had created a mostly male population, and that undoubtedly also added to the turmoil, because when you have a very skewed demographic like that, I mean, it's, again, this is a cliche from Western movies, but I think historical research has proven that it was largely true. When you have a combination of young men, they're not living where they feel any sense of responsibility to either a wife or a mother, and there's great access to alcohol, you're going to have a fairly violent situation. And in fact, there's a very good book I just could mention, this is an aside, called Murder in New York by a late historian at UCLA, Eric Munkinen, and he actually did a long statistical analysis of homicide in New York, and he said, you know, each immigrant group that came in, the people who were already there would say, oh, those, you know, fill in the blank, Irish, Italians, whatever, they're so violent. And he said, really what it is, this is his major conclusion, is that when you have a bunch of young men immigrating without their families to restrain them, you're going to have violence, rather than it's inherent in the nature of whatever the newest immigrant group might be. So that's what California was all about. Well, in September of 1859, there was a particular episode that was very bloody in its conclusion. There were almost, the Republican Party, which at that time was the party of anti-slavery, of limiting the extension of slavery, it was pretty weak in California. And so the main conflict was within the Democratic Party. You had the pro-Southern Democrats, who were known as the Chivalry or Shivs, and then you had the other wing, which was led by a San Francisco politician named David Broderick. Well, David Broderick and William Gwynne, this leading Shiv, did not get along, and one of Gwynne's lieutenants was another Southerner, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, whose name was David Terry. David Terry said of David Broderick that he was closer, you know, David Broderick called himself a Stephen Douglas, that is a Northern Democrat. He was a Stephen Douglas Democrat. David Terry said that Broderick was closer to Frederick Douglass, the black abolitionist, than Stephen Douglas. Now, you might think that that might be a compliment, but it caused a duel. I mean, David Broderick opposed the extension of slavery, but he was a Democrat, and in those days the Democrats were the party of placating the South, even if they were Northerners. So in September of 1859, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court resigned, and the next day he and Broderick fought a duel. And a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court killed a sitting U.S. Senator. David Broderick was a senator. The only such event in American history where, well, of course, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, but Broderick was the only U.S. senator to be killed in a duel. And they went just over the county line into San Mateo County. There's still, if you drive around San Francisco, there's a plaque where that duel took place. And about 8 months later, Thomas Starr King arrived in San Francisco. So do you think he had his hands full? comes from Boston. And let me just say briefly about King. He was a self-educated man. His father had died when he was very young, and he had to support his mother and his younger siblings. So he had to drop out of high school. But he read, he was mentored by, his father had been a Universalist minister, and at first King becomes a Universalist minister. At that point, you didn't have to go to college to be a Universalist minister, but you did to be a Unitarian minister. But he was so eloquent that a Unitarian congregation called him in Boston, even though he lacked a Harvard degree, which was unheard of. And he worked his way up to be a very well-known, well-respected figure in Boston. One of the fun things that I was able to do in my research was follow the trajectory of his relationship with Ralph Waldo Emerson. At first he says, oh, the great man, you know, and then pretty soon they're exchanging letters. And so he was part of that group, that literary circle, of which Emerson was the most noted member. At first, King was not full-on abolitionist because he had to bring his congregation along with him. But by the late 1850s, he was quite a well-known figure in Boston as an outspoken abolitionist. And one of the moments that where he really became just impassioned about racial justice came with the Dred Scott decision. In January of 1857, the Supreme Court said that Dred Scott, a former slave who had sued to get his freedom, saying that his master had taken him from a slave state to a free state and that he had then become free, Roger Taney's Supreme Court said, no, that a black man had no rights which a white man was bound to respect, that blacks could not be citizens, and that the Missouri Compromise had been illegal. It was completely pro-South, and that decision, scholars agree that it was the most disgraceful Supreme Court decision of all time, though lately but I shouldn't editorialize. Anyhow, Starking, who had been cautious at first, he denounces the Dred Scott decision. So by the time he came to San Francisco, where duels were being fought over being an abolitionist, he is an abolitionist. He is hanging out with abolitionists. He is giving abolitionist speeches. And he really did come, I think, on a bit of a mission to California, to, you know, the Civil War is in the offing. He gets here in late April of 1860. That duel that I told you about was September of 1859. So it's like 7 months later or something like that. And His correspondence is so interesting. The King family gets here. They took a ship down to Panama and then went across the isthmus and then back up. Gets here on a Saturday, and he's met by a committee from First Unitarian in San Francisco. And they tell him, well, we don't expect you to preach tomorrow. And King says, oh, yes, I'm going to preach tomorrow. And one of the fun things, I found a letter written in early May. I mean, this is like April 26th. And the guy says, we know you preached immediately because the news was carried by Pony Express to St. Louis and then telegraphed to us in Boston. And so there was tremendous public excitement. He had been also a figure on the Lyceum circuit. He was the first bona fide New England intellectual to come to California and settle. And people were excited. The Fremonts, the most famous couple in California, immediately, they were Episcopalians they started attending First Unitarian. I mean, he was the center of attention. And he began to make his views about racial justice known. But the single most remarkable moment, and I just want you to think about this, this climate that had been so antithetical to any talk of racial justice. On August 1st, 1860, he gave a talk to the small black community in San Francisco, a few hundred people. And in that talk, I have a long quote from it, and I want to read it. He said, it was August 1st is the anniversary of British emancipation. Of course, there wasn't slavery in Britain itself, but there was slavery in the British possessions in the Caribbean. In August 1st, 1833, the British ended slavery in their Caribbean colonies. And he says, King says, wherever we find many races brought together, there God has his greatest work to do. There is room for the noblest labor of Christianity. The greatest work that was ever wrought by the early Christians was when the disciples went beyond the borders of Judea and controverted the current doctrine that the Gentiles had no rights that a Jew was bound to respect. And here he's using and making fun of the language of the Dred Scott decision. The newspaper account says that there were cheers and laughter at this point, since the audience would have recognized that he was making fun of the Dred Scott decision. And back to the quote, and taught that Christianity had no respect for rank, color, or sect. The Almighty had a great mission for this nation. Here the church was to proclaim the equality of the races. Wherever the oppressed were congregated, there Christ was present and not on the side of power. Into such a presence I always come with reverence. Well, no prominent white person had said anything remotely resembling that. And in fact, I mean, listen to this language. Wherever we find many races brought together, there God has his greatest work to do. I mean, this is full out, racial diversity is a good thing. It's not just that slavery is bad, it's that the Almighty has a mission for the U.S. because here the church was to proclaim the equality of the races. Not too many people were saying things like that in 1860. And his audience was in tears at the end of it. And he continued to talk in these terms at the time, in fact, oh my gosh. This is a wonderful moment to be talking about this. This is August of 2012. In late August, exactly 150 years ago, was a terrible Union loss at Second Bull Run. Late August of 1862, and Thomas Starr King gives public speeches in which he says, we've got to use black troops. That was controversial. Abolitionist should no longer be a dirty word. And on September 17th, almost exactly 150 years ago, that was the Battle of Antietam, where the Union finally wasn't an unqualified victory, but much better than Bull Run, which had preceded it by a few weeks. That was the victory Lincoln was waiting for. And so on September 22nd of 1862, that was the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. So all this, you know, for the next few weeks, there's going to be 150th anniversary after another. And that same week of Antietam and the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, this is when Thomas Starr King begins to make impassioned speeches And he actually had written to a Unitarian colleague in Henry Bellows in the East saying, I couldn't really throw myself into the fundraising for the Sanitary Commission until I knew the war was going to be a war to end slavery. That week, almost 150 years ago, Thomas Starr King stirred up the population of San Francisco to raise money for the Sanitary Commission, which was not publicly funded, but was doing the work of helping soldiers who were wounded. It was, when the war broke out, there were 26 Army doctors. There was no bureaucracy to take care of wounded men. And it was really cobbled together by volunteers with Unitarians playing a leadership role. So this is not some ancillary activity. This was central to taking care of the soldiers. And because of Thomas Starr King's ardor, within 1 week, you know how much the business community of San Francisco raised? $100,000 in 1862 dollars. And there was a one-year-old transcontinental telegraph. They wired it to the Sanitary Commission office in New York and said, here's $100,000 on deposit with your, you know, it was a pretty electrifying moment. California raised four times more than any other state. So we can celebrate our denomination's role. A Unitarian minister is the first one that really says California is all about racial diversity. He threw California, he really changed the political climate in California with his impassioned speeches, and he got California mobilized. We couldn't fight directly very easily, although 17,000 men did volunteer from California, but that's another whole long story. But he really mobilized California in an incredibly creative way to give money to the relief of soldiers. One small town, Suisun, near Fairfield, the women raised $3,486 with a bake sale. So, I mean, he really got people fired up. And so I think it's a history of which we can be very proud, and it was my great delight to do this research, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I think that's a really good question. The question is, why is Thomas Starr King relatively little known? I think there's, at the time, the California contributions to the Sanitary Commission, his impassioned rhetoric was a big story. I know this because I read the letters that prominent people like Wendell Phillips, who was, other than William Lloyd Garrison, the most prominent white abolitionist. Wendell Phillips writes to him and says, you know, I'm a shrub at your feet. You're on the mountaintop. And somebody, a Unitarian minister who was in Paris, said, the fame of what you're doing has come all the way to Paris. Because California was such a new state, and it had been so tenuously connected in a lot of ways. There was no transcontinental railroad yet. And then all of a sudden, there's this outpouring of largesse from this brand new state. And so it was a big national story at the time. I think the West has faded out of the national narrative. I mean, one of the reasons this book is not a biography per se, what I say explicitly in my preface is that the West, after all, what was going to happen, whether California was going to be slave or free, that was one of the triggers for the Civil War. And then the West just has fallen out of the national narrative. And I think California belongs back in the national narrative. And also, I've thought about this a lot, because I've been a women's historian, I've seen how great women have fallen out of our historical narrative. We seem to remember the mass murderers and people who take life more than we remember the ones who are out there doing humane things. I mean, everybody knows about Billy the Kid, Pretty Boy Floyd, etc. You know, psychopathic murderers, Jack the Ripper in England. And I will say that I worked with the UU Legislative Ministry at the time that the statue was demoted, shall we say. I organized a letter-writing campaign among historians, and I faxed this petition with, you know, all these signatures to then Governor Schwarzenegger, and I got no response whatsoever. Yes. I take your point. The question is, how much did capitalism have to do with the Civil War? That's the larger point. Let me just say that after Starr King died, tragically young in 1864, California reverted to being a democratic state. California did not ratify either the 14th or the 15th Amendments. So it's not as if there was some real groundswell. It reverted, and the first Democratic governor after the Civil War, Henry Haight, was a San Francisco businessman. I think that there's an economic cause, but I think that the racial cause is more important. And I commend to you the work, a wonderful book by Eric Foner, who's also a left historian, whose father and uncles were all fired in a purge in New York City for their red leanings. The book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and Slavery. And you will find that Eric Foner has a more nuanced view than what you're suggesting. Well, there you go. Eric Foner is pretty right on, I think. And he was elected president of the Organization of American Historians a few years ago. And in his opening remarks, he said, "This means so much to me because my family was all fired in a red purge in New York. I think it's CCNY. Yeah. Getting this history back to the kids, I couldn't agree more, and I never give a talk but what I don't say. We need a fourth grade level biography of Thomas Starr King. Kids need to know that a prominent white person came to California and said, racial diversity. I mean, we have, when he got here, there's Chinese, there's the Californios, the Latinos, etc. And he says this is a good thing. And that's, since there's still people out there who want to say that racial diversity inevitably means conflict and, you know, it equals bad, I think that would be a wonderful project. I don't have the skills myself, but I really would like to see a biography. It was because he came right back after the Civil War, and some of the, like William Gwynne and David Terry, who was essentially a murderer, they left for the Confederacy. But after that election in 1867, where the Democrats took power again, they come back. And the Stars and Stripes could not be flown in Los Angeles after Fort Sumter until troops arrived from Fort Tejon. So Southern California was a hotbed of Confederacy. So I would say it was a long time. And of course, we have in the 1870s the anti-Chinese stuff in San Francisco. So if we're looking for the moment at which California begins to be racially enlightened, I think we have to move forward till the 1960s and the civil rights movement and civil rights activism in many parts of California. I wish it were a happier story, but it's not. Thank you.